To an hour of mind power. Well, we, as always, have good stuff to share with you, but today, get those pads of paper and pens out because we are talking food. Mm-hmm. This is time to get your tummy ready and your taste buds just watering because our guest today is Susan O'Brien, and we're going to be talking about gluten-free cooking. And she has a wonderful cookbook that she has put out. And Susan, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Donna.
And nice where are you located?
I live in Gig Harbor, Washington.
Aha, one of my favorite places in the world. That's where the Washington Renaissance Fair is happening out there near Purdy.
Yes, it is. Actually, it's been going on since last weekend.
That's right, and I was out there last weekend. So it's just a wonderful event, and it's a gorgeous, gorgeous area. But let's get down to you. You are a woman that has such an interesting background, and I would love for you to tell my audience how you got involved with gluten-free cooking. I mean, we all love food, but so many people have a problem with food sensitivities, and so much of the food out there for people that have allergies is so... Whoa. I mean, it is bad tasting. So you came up with this wonderful cookbook. In fact, I even tried some of your recipes. So tell me how you got started in this.
Well, it's pretty interesting because I actually have a business, and I was baking for a gourmet grocery store, and they had me bring in baked goods every day for their clients and their customers. And I was just tasting all of the things I was eating and enjoying it very much. But I started having some problems with my stomach. And at the time, I was also working full-time for a company in Gig Harbor that had a research center. And they did studies on different medical conditions that people had, and I volunteered for one of the studies to see if I qualified, and I didn't. But interestingly enough, the test results showed that I had gluten sensitivity as well as some other medical underlying issues going on, and so they asked me if I would participate in an elimination diet. An elimination diet. I didn't know what it was, but what it is actually is a way to identify problem foods that people eat. And so many of us eat bread and pasta and noodles and lots of things that are made with wheat. And the doctor suggested that perhaps wheat was giving me a problem. And gluten is in wheat products. It is part of the grain that makes up the protein in wheat. And he said, I think you have an allergy to it. And I said, oh, no, I'm sure I don't. And so they ran the test, the elimination diet, which is a test in you actually eliminate all of the most common foods that cause people to have problems for a period of about 3 weeks.
And then slowly you add
those foods back into your diet. And you wait to see if your body has a reaction. Well, I cut out wheat and sugar and dairy and soy and corn and peanuts, you know, all of the common foods that can cause problems. And then I slowly started adding them back one at a time. Well, guess which one gave me the problems?
I bet you it's the wheat.
It was.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in denial. So I said, oh, I'm sure that's not what it is. I think I just have a virus. Well, they said, wait about 3 or 4 days and do it again. Because what happened was I felt sick. I had a headache and I had a rash on my legs and I just felt malaise. I just felt really poorly. So I waited 3 or 4 days, and that's so that your body has time to eliminate the toxin. And then I tried it again. Well, I had the exact same reaction.
Mm.
So I was diagnosed as having sensitivity to gluten. So that's how I went off of it. And interestingly enough, at the time, I was working for the Functional Medicine Research Center and the Institute for Functional Medicine in Gig Harbor, and they were putting on medical conferences for doctors. And so the doctors wanted to eat healthy because so many of their patients had food allergies or medical conditions that required them to be on a modified diet. So they said, why don't you bring in some of the foods that you are eating and let us try them? And guess what happened?
Well,
they fell in love with them.
They fell in love with them. Now, what were you taking into them? Had you started making muffins? What exactly were you doing?
Well, you know, I was so frustrated, Donna, because when I went on the elimination diet, I was told, now you have to be off of all of these foods, and once you start, you know, finding out which foods you're allergic to, you have to stop eating them. And I said, well, what in the world am I supposed to eat?
Mm-hmm.
I was told I couldn't eat corn anymore, I couldn't eat gluten, I couldn't have dairy. And I came home and I stood there and looked in my refrigerator and my cupboards and I said, well, what am I going to eat? I love to eat and I want to eat good, healthy food because nutrition is very important to me. So what I did was I started experimenting in the kitchen. And so I used the participants that came to our conferences as my guinea pigs. And I brought in Marionberry bars, and I brought in granola bars, and I brought in pumpkin muffins and gingerbread. And, you know, all of the desserts were gluten-free, and
okay.
They just loved them.
I have to ask you something, because it has been suggested to me that I sort of eliminate wheat pretty much out of my program. So I'm just going to use me as an example. So when I decided I was going to try to do this, I went in and I got very industrious. I was reading some stuff. In fact, I had gotten your cookbook, in fact, and I was going through it and I said, oh boy, these pancakes look good. This pumpkin stuff looks pretty good. I think I'm going to try it. So I thought, well, I'm going to experiment with different things because I have my favorite recipes, and I'm sure some of my listeners do too. You know, you have mom's bread recipe or you have this other recipe and, oh, it just turns out so good. And every time you have company, they just go wild over it. But you're not supposed to have wheat. So I've tried different recipes and using rice flour or I'll grind up my own oatmeal, you know, so make the oatmeal flour and I'll do things like that. But, oh, my gracious, it came out like lead pancakes.
I know, Donna. I actually made something the first time I was trying to experiment. I made something even my dog wouldn't eat.
I mean, you can eat them in hockey pucks, for heaven's sake.
I know. I mean, it was so bad. So it does take some creativity and some sense of humor when you're starting out. But I went through the same thing, and what I did and what I hope my book does for others is eliminate that period of frustration of trying to figure out what does taste good, because you know, you can't just automatically substitute rice flour in a recipe. And a clear example is bread. Rice bread is very crumbly and falls apart. So for a person who has to give up bread, if you're an Italian or
mm-hmm.
if you're somebody who loves French bread and you love to dip it in olive oil and balsamic vinegar, which I do, there truly isn't a bread substitute that has the same consistency. But that's the secret, is you have to adjust what you're used to.
All right. Now, let me stop you there. I want you to give us your favorite recipe for bread, because I know that there's nothing to equal bread. And if you're going to have company, you often want to have something that they can slather butter on when it's nice and hot, because it's one of people's favorite foods. There's nothing to beat the smell of freshly baked bread. And, of course, if you use wheat flour, white flour, even your whole wheat flour, I mean, it just is absolutely wonderful, and it works well with yeast. Give us a recipe that we can use.
For bread? Actually, what I would do is I would actually refer you to Betty Hagman's gluten-free book for breads. She did a whole book on breads, because I don't do many breads, Donna. What I do is cornbread, and I do scones, and I do muffins, but I have found breads to be one of the most difficult foods to make. And my book is all sugar-free as well as gluten-free, and I really focus on a lot of dairy-free recipes as well, because that's another common allergen. So quite honestly, I had a huge dinner party last night, and I didn't serve bread. I really think that our society, you know, is so used to the types of foods we grew up with, we think we have to have them, when in fact, if you give them up, eventually you stop craving them. So bread isn't something I really focus my attention on. Although, as I said, I have a great cornbread recipe, and I do a lot of scones and muffins and things like that, but I don't make bread.
All right, let's talk about the scones, because people love those. And for breakfast, with strawberry preserves, your favorite marmalade,
absolutely.
It's wonderful.
And, you know, there's so many different kinds of scones that you can do. You can do, like, an Irish scone, which is just made with, you know, with baking powder. You can make scones with oats. You can make oat scones. I love sweet potato scones.
Do you have that recipe?
You know, that recipe is in my cookbook. And I make potato scones. There's a lot of different kinds of scones. And again, scones are so basic that, yes, I do have a recipe for that in my cookbook. And there are a lot of things that you can add to them. That's the beauty about being creative in the kitchen, is using your imagination and just adding things to them. So I have an oat scone in my cookbook that I just love. Now, but with oats, and one of the things about oats is you have to be very careful, because if you have true celiac disease, oats are something that are off limits unless you have guaranteed that the source of oats are coming from a facility that does not produce glutinous products.
Oh, that's interesting.
It is very important. So steel-cut oats tend to be the most safe. And the United States and Canadian celiac organizations do not endorse celiacs eating oats unless they know that the source of them are certified to be from a gluten-free environment.
Now,
because it's the cross-contamination, mm-hmm. Donna, mm-hmm. that causes the problems.
Well, you'll see on many products where they will, and you read the labels. I have a friend, for example, who's allergic to peanuts, digressing for just a minute. So he has to read every label if it has any possibility of being in touch with peanuts and any of the processing. And like you say, many factories, many food manufacturing facilities will do multiple jobs. And so they have to list on the package the equipment sometimes is used for processing peanut products and so on and so forth. And so he doesn't touch it then. He won't have anything to do with it because he's so extremely sensitive. So he has to be aware of that. So it's the same thing with people when it comes to the wheat and certain products. That's a marvelous point to bring out.
It's very important. And, you know, people like me who just have a gluten intolerance, it's not life-threatening, but just like your friend with a peanut allergy, if you truly are allergic to gluten, you can have quite a horrible reaction to any product that has wheat in it. And, you know, in the old days, they didn't list all of the products on food labels, and thank goodness they do today, because it saved many people's lives, I'm sure.
Oh, yes, it saved his. Okay, let's have your scone recipe.
Okay, well, the oat scones have a third of a cup of vegetable oil, and I love grapeseed oil. It is very good for you, and you can find it in your local grocery store, but any vegetable oil, not olive oil, because that's too heavy, but like a canola oil would work, and 2 tablespoons of, now, this may sound funny, but I use agave cactus nectar. And that is a sweetener that comes from the cactus plant, and it is suitable for diabetics. And my book is gluten-free and sugar-free, so that people who have diabetes or other medical conditions that have to eliminate both gluten or sugar from their diets can benefit from the book. But if you don't need to worry about that, you could put in 2 tablespoons of honey and 2 tablespoons of warm water, 1 tablespoon of lemon juice, and that's optional. You can leave it out if you don't want it, a half a cup of oat flour, and a half a teaspoon of baking soda, a third of a cup of currants, or if you can't find currants, then just use raisins, and a third of a cup of rolled oats. Now, one of the things that you want to do is go ahead and preheat your oven, and then you're going to combine the oil and either your agave cactus nectar or your honey, and water and lemon juice, and you're going to heat that in a saucepan until the oil and the sweetener come together and kind of combine. You're going to stir it around a little bit for just a few minutes until it kind of congeals. And then you're going to remove it from the heat, and you're going to set it aside while you take another bowl, and you're going to mix together the oat flour and the baking soda. Then you're going to also, at that point, you're going to add in a little bit of salt. I would say maybe, a quarter teaspoon or so of salt, just a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're going to add in the oil mixture, and then you're going to add in the currants, and you're going to beat it with a wooden spoon until it's all stirred together. Then you're going to add a little bit more of the oat flour until you can form it all into a ball. You don't want it to be real sticky. You want to be able to split the dough in half and make two equal parts. And then you're going to take those rolled oats, about a quarter of a cup of those rolled oats, and you're going to spread them out on your work surface. And you're going to roll one of the balls into the oats, and then press it down until it's in about a 5-inch circle. And it's going to be about a half an inch thick. And then you're going to place that on a cookie sheet that you've kind of lightly sprayed with a vegetable spray so it doesn't stick. And then you're going to place some of those the rest of those oats on that cookie sheet. And then you're going to put those scones right on top. And you're going to go ahead and bake those for about 20, 25 minutes until they're lightly browned. And you're going to cool them on a rack. But before you cool them, or while they're cooling, before they get too cold, you kind of want to score them. You want to cut them in half and then cut them in half again. So you're going to end up with 8 scones altogether.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I know there's nothing like a hot scone with soft butter and
and some raspberry jam.
Oh, it's great. Or just plain honey, you know.
Honey, yes.
Yeah, and there's for people that are watching their sugar, they can use the all-fruit preserves. There's just so many ways that can be enjoyed. And there's nothing like the fragrance of oatmeal cooking, I think, when you have, and I'm one, I'd probably throw in some cinnamon and nutmeg and do all of that. Now, with the work that you've been involved with some of the doctors, and you're so active interacting with other people, helping them to come into an understanding that they don't have to feel deprived in their life. You have made sugar a very significant part of your book, especially in being able to use substitutes. And that's one of the things that's very nice about your book. You have all kinds of substitutions for different things. Now, if someone didn't want to use yeast, what else would you recommend in some of the mixtures? You mentioned baking soda, and there is something, and I've got it on the tip of my tongue. In fact, it's down in my pantry. I picked it up. It's a product that you can add to help. Instead of using yeast, it helps the various grains to rise if you're using non-wheat products. And I'm trying to think of the name of it, and it's escaping me right now.
Instead of yeast?
Well,
For leavening, what works best is a combination of baking soda and baking powder together. And then to hold or bind it together, because when gluten is very binding and it holds baked goods like your breads and your muffins and all of that together. So when you don't have that, what you want to do is add a very odd product. It's called xanthan gum.
That's what I was trying to think of.
That's it.
I was totally unaware of it until I started exploring.
And it's very interesting. It actually works to hold. It's a binder, and it works to hold your product together. And so when you're making cookies or you're making muffins or biscuits, it's good to use a teaspoon of that in your recipe. Like if I make a batch of cookies, and I make cookies a lot, I'll just throw in a teaspoon of xanthan gum so that my cookies aren't crumbly. It helps.
Now, is it just a teaspoon, like for an ordinary batch, or would you use Can you use more? I mean, is it going to make a difference if you use more than a teaspoon?
No, it has no flavor. You wouldn't want to use a tablespoon instead of a teaspoon, but if you were making a cake, for instance, you might want to use 2 teaspoons. And if you were making a batch of cookies, you might just want to use 1 because, again, you want to do it in comparison to the size of the product that you are developing. So your recipes will tell you basically how much xanthan gum to use. But again, you can experiment. And you know, it's so funny because I'm in the process of developing a cookie for Alternative Therapies magazine right now. And I'm using just teff flour, and that's spelled T as in Thomas, EFF, like
I've
Frank.
I've heard of it.
It's a very unusual flour, and it doesn't hold together very well. So I've been experimenting with the xanthan gum to get the right combination so the cookie feels and tastes like a regular cookie.
Now, I'm going to have to ask you a question here. With all of this testing that you're doing, what do you do with your rejects?
Well, my dog has been he's been quite helpful in getting rid of some things, but you know, he has his own food allergies, quite honestly. So they go in the garbage. And you know what I have found, Donna, is when you are experimenting, and this is very helpful for your listeners, don't make the whole amount. Start with a small amount and cut a recipe in half. If you're trying to make a new recipe from your old family favorite, don't make the whole batch. Just cut it down so that if it does bomb, you're not wasting so many ingredients.
Now, I want to ask you, when you have a regular recipe, for example, you'll have a recipe, you know, for muffins. One of the things with muffins is you don't use a whole bunch of liquid. When you're using these alternative flours, like this flour you just mentioned, do you have to use more water? I know if you use oat flour, when I was experimenting with some of the things that you had in your book, my husband said, Donna, use more water because the oat flour just absorbs so much.
I know.
I thought, okay, I'll try that. But I was still, you know, again, like you say, it's experimenting. And we had a good laugh over the hockey pucks I produced.
I made some of those hockey pucks.
Anyway, I just thought, you know, and I hadn't followed, you know, I was improvising on my own, and as we all try to do when we enjoy cooking, but it's fun, you know, when you joke about these things, like when you talk about the chicken rock special you fixed or something. But getting back to the gluten-free, you have not just the gluten-free, you have the sugar-free. And what other substitutes do you use for sugar?
Well, my absolute favorite is the agave cactus nectar, and you can buy that in, you know, at Fred Meyer's, at any Whole Foods market, any health food store carries it, and a lot of the stores now, because people are so much more health conscious, or bigger stores are carrying it, like Safeways and so forth. But it's wonderful because it has no aftertaste. It's very low on the glycemic index. And if you're a diabetic or somebody who has to watch the amount of sugar intake that you consume, you want to make sure that the foods that you're eating are lower on the glycemic index. And sugar is very, very high. It scores 80 on the out of 100. Agave cactus nectar only scores 11.
Mm-hmm.
And the glycemic index is a way to rate the carbohydrates in the foods that we eat. And so for those people that are trying to eliminate sugar, they want to stay with the more complex carbohydrates, not the empty calories that sugar contains. And so that's my favorite. But there's another one, and that is called kiwi sweetener.
Mm-hmm.
I don't use that as often because it's very expensive, but it's made from the actual kiwi fruit.
Mm-hmm.
Again, maple syrup is an option.
That's my favorite.
Yes, I like maple syrup too. And then I use a fruit sweetener that is a combination of peach, pear, and pineapple puree.
Ooh.
And that's very good, but it is higher in sugar content than the agave cactus nectar and molasses. or maple syrup. And another one, which I really love for things that you want to bind together, and that is brown rice syrup.
Brown rice syrup?
Mm-hmm, brown rice syrup.
Hmm.
And it is just brown rice, water, and some natural enzymes. And it digests very slowly in the body as well, but it's also very dense. And so you don't want to use that for something that you would like to be light, for instance, a muffin or a cake, because it would make it more like we were talking about earlier, those little hockey pucks.
Mm-hmm.
But if you were making granola bars or you were making brown rice pudding and you wanted to sweeten that, it would be perfect for that.
Well, you give a lot of options in your gluten-free cookbook, Susan, and I know we can get it at Amazon.com, and people wanted to contact you about this. What is your website?
My website is www.glutenfreesugarfreecooking.com.
Repeat that again. Gluten-free, sugar-free, cooking?
Cooking.com.
All right, so that's gluten-free, sugar-free, cooking.com. For those of you that would just like to pop over, you're listening to us on the Internet, so if you just wanted to pop over and visit her site, she'd be able to do that. She's got all kinds of wonderful things there. Susan, your book is also wonderful because there are people, just like you said, that are wanting to cut back on their carbohydrates. They're wanting to have things that taste good, that are on the sweet side, and you don't want to feel deprived. And that's the wonderful part about what you offer in your cookbook. And you've got different recipes for different meals. You go into appetizers, all kinds of things. It's a wonderful cookbook to have around, and it's also a good cookbook to have if you have guests that are coming. I find many times my guests that I have at, you know, different gatherings during the year. Some of them, I had one lady that was allergic to walnuts, someone else that it's allergic to wheat, someone else that can't have too much sugar. And you could drive yourself nuts if you did not have something like this kind of a cookbook in your kitchen. You say, let me thumb through here and let's see what I can come up with. It's really amazing how good the food can taste.
It's true, and you know, that's the thing that I focused on, is I didn't want people to have to reinvent the wheel. I wanted people to be able to pick it up and make any recipe and enjoy it. And even if you have children who have food allergies, and you say, well, they have to eat a certain way, but we don't want to eat that food because it doesn't taste good. It really can taste good.
Oh, I agree. And I think fresh food is always wonderful. And there's another ingredient that when you are fixing this and you are a good cook and you're putting all that love into what you do, it can't help but even taste better.
I agree. I really believe that the energy we put into the preparation of food is the energy that we get from the food we eat.
Oh, I think so. I really think there's a big difference. I know I love to cook, and I'm so delighted that you've been with me today because I know so many people have problems with various things in food, and when sometimes in your life all of a sudden the body does a chemistry shift and you've got to give something up. Today in our world, people like Susan O'Brien with her gluten-free, sugar-free cookbook, my gracious, you've got so many choices, and they're good choices. You don't have to use artificial anything. It's all good food. Susan, thank you for being my guest.
Well, thank you, Don. It's been a pleasure.
Been a delight. This is Donna Sebo. We are going to be taking a break. Hey, if you want to call in later, you can. 877-876-5227 is that telephone number that you can dial toll-free. Again, Susan's website is glutenfreesugarfreecooking.com. Stop by for a visit. You will not regret it. Thank you again, Susan, and we're taking a break. Don't you go away now. We'll be right back.
Bye.
Bye-bye, Susan.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Take care.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hi, this is Donna Sebo. And again, if you'd like to get a copy of Susan O'Brien's gluten-free, sugar-free cookbook, go to her website, glutenfreesugarfreecooking.com, glutenfreesugarfreecooking.com, and you'll be able to find out everything that you need to know. There is so much that is going on at the Washington Renaissance Family Fair. I can tell you this past weekend, it was absolutely a pleasure. I met so many wonderful people out there. And if you have a chance to go, you really should make it a special event for your family, your friends. Tell your neighbors about it and come on out. Now, I know for you in different parts of the country, you may say, gee, Donna, we're not going to be able to get out there. But for those of you that are listening from Washington State, by golly, it's a wonderful event. You walk onto these grounds that are pastures during the rest of the year, and they are transformed magically into a 16th century environment. It's absolutely incredibly wonderful, and they have this wonderful castle front that is there, and you have these people in costumes that are walking all over the place dressed in just wonderful attire. Some of it looks a little strange because you may encounter a gnome every once in a while or a fairy person, perhaps a goblin. We even have a 12-foot giant that goes around and shakes hands with children. It's a wonderful, wonderful experience. And again, it's for the entire family. Now, you can get your tickets, a discount on them, if you'll go into our website, Washington Renaissance Fair, Washington Ren Fair, RENFAIRE.com. Go to the WashingtonRenFair.com, and there you can get your tickets at discount prices, and you can print them out. And boy, will that save time at the gate. We had long lines on Saturday and Sunday of this past weekend, and so you don't want to have to stand in those long lines. You want to be able to get right in and get started with all the events and all of the wonderful fun that goes on. I remember talking with some people who were so excited about seeing the jousting, and then somebody else was going off to watch the archery competition. And the kids, it is just a joy to watch the children because their eyes get so big and they giggle and they laugh and they see all kinds of wonderful characters. They just have a wonderful, wonderful time. So if you can make it one of these two weekends that are left for this wonderful event, the hours are from 10 until 6, ample parking, prices are just great. Go to the website Washington Ren Fair, F-A-I-R-E. Don't forget to put the E on the end of fair. And they'll have all the information there for you. And it's wonderful. And come by, say hello, visit my booth. I've got beautiful golden banners with big, big red lions on them. You can't miss it. And I'm right at the end of Main Street when you first come in the gate to the right. So I hope you'll stop by and say hello. I'd love to see you, and I'm doing many consultations while I'm there. So it is an exciting event. It was just marvelous this past weekend, and I wouldn't want you to miss it. If you can possibly come, make a date. Come on out. We'd love to see you there. I wanted to also let you know that we are going to have some interesting guests this week. We're going to have tomorrow Carol Edmondson, the Doodle Lady. Now, Carol is a woman that I've had the privilege of having as a guest before, and she's going to have a very special personal experience to share with you about how doodling made her life bearable through some very, very difficult times. But it is a habit many of us have, that we'll just sit, if we're busy, we're just doodling on a piece of napkin or a piece of paper, and we're drawing circles or stars or something. Well, she has created it into an art form that really has some very positive effects. So we'll be talking with Carol Edmondson tomorrow. And then we're going to be talking about induced after-death communication with Alan Botkin, a fascinating subject. And again, a little bit unique, but I'll tell you what, unique is what makes life interesting. And then we're going to be talking with Dr. Diamond, Facets of a Diamond. We're going to be talking about the developing of self, and he is going to give us his wisdom and insight relative to that. Then we have next week some wonderful, wonderful guests, Perry Garfinkel. We're going to be talking with this gentleman who works for National Geographic. He's a photographer, travels all over the world, and he's put out a book called Buddha or Bust. It's a fabulous book, lots of humorous experiences that he has in it, and I know we'll have a good time with him. Then we're also going to be talking with David Taylor. We're going to be talking about ginseng. This is called the divine root, and boy, does he know his history. So we're going to be learning a lot about that wonderful, wonderful item. And then animals, well, I have a very soft spot in my heart for all kinds of animals, as I know so many of you do. Mary Getton, she communicates with orcas, and her book is all about that, and it is absolutely mesmerizing. I could hardly put it down. And then we're going to have an open mic day on the 17th, and then after that we're going to be talking to Jared Rosen. We're going to be talking about the flip, how to turn your world around. So we just have so many different things on the show. And it's just a delight to be able to receive material from these people and then to have the opportunity to bring it to you. Because I think the way we expand our world is by learning and listening and opening ourselves up to different concepts and ideas. You don't have to take it all in. You just say, that's interesting. Or, I've never heard of that perspective before. I wonder. I think a word that should be very much a real part of our experience is curiosity. And children have it naturally. And as we grow up into adulthood, often we suffocate our factor of curiosity. And it's a shame when we do that because there's so many wonderful things that we can explore. And when we start to get curious about life and when we start to ask questions, we're revitalized because we realize there's more to life than often what we're occupied with at the moment. So curiosity gives us a zest of exploration, enthusiasm. It's sort of an investment in the unknown. And my goodness, doesn't that appeal to you in some way? Maybe not. But I know it sure is fascinating to me. It seems like there isn't a day that goes by where I don't learn something new, and it's marvelous. And you know what's even nicer? So often I find when something new comes into my space, I'm able to pass along the information to someone else, and it brightens their world as well. And you know, it also makes for very good conversation. You'll always have something to talk about if you have an attitude for learning and for being curious about life. Quincy Jones made a comment. He said, when you're over the hill, that's when you pick up speed. I want to know what hill he's talking about. But the thing is, he's right. When we go through our ups and downs in life, when you get over the hill, wherever that bump may be, whether you're a young kid or you're an older, mature, golden-aged individual or somewhere in between, we're all going to have our hills in life. And once we get over them, like he said, we pick up momentum and then we're off and we're on our way to doing something new and something different. And that sort of just dovetails with what I said about curiosity and learning. I think that that's just so very, very important. Let me tell you how a zest for life that one individual had changed what she did and changed her environment and association with other people as well. Rosie is the lady that put this information together. She said she is a New York gal, and she loves dogs. And she has her special canine companion, Schmitty. And Ellie said, you know, this is a friend of Rosie. She said, my terrier, who's 5.5 years old, she's got this kind of face that she just makes people smile. And she said, you know, I wonder if my little dog can have even a more powerful influence on people. And she happened to look down at a bracelet that she had gotten, and on the bracelet it said, Live Strong. And she said, I wonder if there would be something like this that could be made for pets, their collars. So there'd be a saying on the collar. Well, now what Ellie did, she designed a Dogs Who Care collar that fits petite Pomeranians as well as massive mastiffs. And then she decided she was going to have the collars made, and she put up her own website called dogswhocare.com. Now that's dogswhocare.com. Now these collars sell for $5, and 100% of the proceeds goes to benefit 11 animal charities across the country. Everything from a Yorkie rescue organization in Pennsylvania to an elephant sanctuary in Tennessee. And she said, how exactly is this little Yorkie that has this winning smile on this real bright and happy face involved with this? Well, Schmitty is not only the spokesdog for the organization, she also has the profound position of being the CEO, canine executive officer. So if that doesn't make you smile, I don't know what will. But anyway, Rosie wrote that story out, and I just thought it was absolutely delightful. And it's something we need to remember. We can always come up with ideas that can make a difference in life. And here's Ellie coming up with something for dog collars, and people are responding to it. They're loving her concept, her idea. Someone listening might say, oh, that's so corny, Donna. But it's an example of what we can do. think of all the friends that Ellie's made and all the new people that have come into her life, bringing their own stories, a whole different perspective of experience into what Ellie thought just was going to be dealing with an innovative idea to raise money for special organizations that take care of animals. Who knows? You may come up with an idea of your own. This is Donna Sebo, and if you'd like to call in and chat with me, give me a buzz at 877-876-5227. That's 877-876-5227. And I'd be delighted to light up your life with a little insight. All I need is your first name or your initial, then just let me tell you what I see. And after that, you're welcome to ask a question about anything that you like. Are you a person that gets very little sleep? Well, it's not too good an idea. A lot of us have a choice of when we want to start to work anymore. Many people have home offices. And increasingly, what they're finding in research is that Americans in general are setting their alarms earlier, not later, but earlier. They're finding about 37 million Americans begin their workday between 4:30 a.m. and 7:59 a.m. every day. Well, I can relate to that because I'm up anywhere between 5 and 5, sometimes earlier, 5 or 5:30. And this is according to the Department of Labor. And businesses from Washington, D.C., Subway, they open at 5 a.m. as of September 2004. To Starbucks, and many of Starbucks stores also open at 5 a.m., are helping us to start these patternings. Starting early has its upsides. Usually traffic is sparse, the workplace lacks distractions, and a 6 a.m. start will have you home when school lets out if you have kids, and this is supposedly the way it's supposed to work. However, they're finding that in many offices, staying late is like the red badge of courage. There is a lady by the name of Ellen Galinsky, and she's the president of Families and Work Institute. She said, we still have this notion that presence equals productivity. She said, now attitudes are changing. Early birds have to slither out the back door if they want to leave pre 5 p.m. and still be team players. Start early, stay late. Well, it might be a good idea if you give yourself a little bit more opportunity to get more rest so that you can have more energy and not end up being so pooped that on the weekend you can't do anything but sleep. Donna Sebo here. We're going to take a break. More good things to share with you when we come back. Don't you go away. 877-876-5227 if you'd like to chat. We'll be right back. Hi, this is Donna Sebo. Apparently, we're having some technical difficulties, so I am just going to move right along. I want to remind you about the wonderful event that I'm participating in this coming weekend. It's the Washington Renaissance Fantasy Fair. And if you would like to acquire some more information about it, then go to the wonderful website of www.washingtonrenfair.com. You will have so much fun. Your friends, your family, your neighbors, all of these wonderful, wonderful people are going to be able to participate in this action-packed environment that is just so fabulous that you are going to say, I've got to come back a second weekend. And you know what? You'll be in luck. Because not only is it this weekend, but we'll have one weekend after that. So you can get your tickets online. You'll find out about the prices. It's at the Mentor Creek Ranch out in Gig Harbor. And all you have to do is go in to WashingtonRenFair.com. And don't forget to put the E on the end of fair. You'll walk through the gates of a castle, and then you'll enter into this 16th century active village. You'll be able to have your kids with you. You can even bring your dog if you want. But if you bring your children, there's a lot of things to show them. They have craftspeople that are there showing you how things were done in the 16th century. So it's educational, but it's more than that. It's a lot of fun, and the food is fabulous. You're going to have wonderful things to munch on while you're walking around. And the vendors, well, they have products from all over the world. So if you want to step back in time, be comfortable, be casual, just have an absolutely fabulous day. There's weekend passes. There's all kinds of specials. Go to Washington Ren Fair. That's the Washington Renaissance Fantasy Fair website. Go to WashingtonRenFair.com, and you'll get it all. You can get your tickets online. They'll give you special discounts, and you will just have a most memorable experience. And be sure to tell your friends when you go home. Again, it's the next two weekends. You don't want to miss it. Donna Sebo here. I wanted to invite you, if you'd like to call in to chat with me and receive a free reading on the air, 877-876-5227. Be sure you tell your friends about bbsradio.com. Shows are archived, and you will have to log in and register. We've had some changes on the website, but we invite you to come along, tell your friends about the shows, and know if you happen to miss any of the shows, you can go into the archives, and you're going to be able to listen at your leisure, whenever that is your pleasure. Are you aware that the ancient mariners had studied quite a few things? They may not or may not have known what we know today about the Earth's magnetic field. However, in the journal Science, there was a study called Fall in Earth's Magnetic Field is Erratic. And what they did in this study, they were trying to measure changes in the Earth's magnetic field generated by, well, pretty active currents of molten iron that lie more than 3,000 miles below the surface. Now, that's quite visual, isn't it? Molten iron. Well, they've got a problem. Apparently, the Earth's magnetic field sculpts the dancing lights of the aurora borealis. It aims compass needles and, more crucially, protects us from the potentially lethal particles spewed out by the sun. But you know what? They're finding that you can't count on it. From time to time, this magnetic field flips, fading away completely before turning north to south. Now, this was a point of information that I thought was rather fascinating. They've found that about 60 such reversals have occurred in the last 20 million years. Now, the last reversal, to the best of their knowledge, occurred about 780,000 years ago. There's a geophysicist, David Gubbins, of the University of Leeds in Britain, who wanted to know if it was time to prepare for the next one. Remember that aspect of curiosity I mentioned? Well, David's got it, and his interest and curiosity is about the magnetic field with the Earth. Now, to forecast flips of the magnetic field on our earthly planet, Mr. Gubbins needed to know what it had done in the past. So scientists have been taking direct measurements of the magnetic field only since 1837. However, mariners have been watching magnetic north far longer. Now, what Gubbins did, he scrutinized more than 150,000 measurements of the inclination and the intensity of Earth's magnetic field. Can you imagine where he got it from? Well, let me tell you, he got them from old ship's logs that included more than 50,000 notes from the East India Company and 7,000 surveys from the voyages of Captain James Cook. Yes, Captain James Cook. Now, he would go through the logs, and he was able to, you know, correct any errors they might have made in location. And he compared the directions of captain's compass needles with the magnetic properties of rocks from the same period. And what this did, this allowed him to construct a timeline of movements in the magnetic field. And he noticed that about 1770, an excursion, a small localized reversal in the magnetic field, apparently blossomed and bloomed near the equator and began to move south. This excursion apparently caused the compasses of mariners to really do funny things, throwing more than one ship off of course. And also, they believe it might have signaled the beginning of the end of the current magnetic field as we know it. And when Gubbins aligned his historical data with current measurements from more than 200 magnetic observatories scattered across the globe, it came to a rather unsettling conclusion. Apparently, for the last 140 years, our magnetic field has been fading at a rapid rate. In fact, it's accelerating. They think it started the acceleration about 1860, shortly after the 1770 excursion vanished. Now, overall, the field stayed nearly constant in strength from 1590 to 1860. However, from 1860 to 1990, well, it sort of was going downhill by about 5% per century. And he said if the magnetic field weakens enough, the North and South Pole will disappear altogether. Compasses won't even be, well, they will be totally useless for a few years to maybe a few thousand years until a new reversed field emerges. At this current rate that it's happening, I don't think we have too much to worry about right now. He speculates, And again, remember, he's speculating. It's going to take about 2,000 years for this happening to happen. He said, while a depleted field will increase our exposure to solar radiation, it doesn't necessarily spell disaster. He said, we've had a lot of these throughout the history of this planet, and you know what? We're still here. We've survived. And he's very much interested in marine navigation because he's a sailor. This is something that's a passion of his, and his home port is in southern Scotland. He said he's a bit old-fashioned. Mr. Goodman still plots his course with a needle and a sextant. He said he also couldn't help noticing details in the ship's logs about life on board, including records of who had been flogged, when, and why. He said, wow, did I acquire a tremendous respect for the early explorers that were using what we would consider very primitive tools. That was David Gibbons. Just a little bit of information about the wonderful planet that we live on. And I'm so glad there are people out there that have this, again, zest for life. They ask questions. Why? What if? Where could we go? What could we do? How can we do it differently? Can we improve something? It's really not a bad way to think about life. There are many things maybe we don't necessarily want to change, but who knows? You may have a brilliant idea, and maybe today's the day to do it. Well, we're at the end of our program this afternoon. It's been a delight being with you. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. This is Donna Seabaugh. I'm so delighted you've been able to be with me. Let your genius flow. After all, you're one of a kind, and we need that spark that you have, and only you can provide it. This is a great day to be alive. Live it to your fullest, because this is what counts, the now. We'll be talking with you tomorrow. Bye for now.